Hello and welcome to The Price of Music, the show that looks at the money behind the music industry with me, Steve Lamack, and Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge. We're recording this just before I head back to Colchester to be a guest as part of the journalist John Robb's show. He's doing a tour of this show, which is called Do You Believe in the Power of Rock and Roll? And it's at the Colchester Arts Centre tonight. Although I don't think there'll be any revelations to match some of the things our Stuart confessed to earlier in the week at an event organised by the BPI. What did you tell the good folk of the music industry?
Yeah, I'm not sure I've improved our credibility. So I told the music industry that I had a Bucks Fizz pillow when I was age 7.
And a Bucks Fizz, a Bucks Fizz pillow?
Bucks Fizz, yeah. I went to see them. My aunt took me to see them and we got merchandise in the form of pillows with them.
Okay.
And I also told them that I lived on baked beans when I was 18 for about a month because I'd spent all my money on gig tickets and t-shirts. And I also told them that when I met Damon Albarn, aged 34, so I was a grown-up, and I had to pluck up the courage to go and talk to him. I had to drink so many drinks that I can't remember a single word of the conversation we had. And there's a photo of us hugging, and I had to check with my friend, like, did I just go and latch onto him? Because that would be really embarrassing. And apparently, no. Apparently, I talked to him, told him how much Blur meant to me. That was the whole point of going up to him. And he hugged me, and it was nice. But I told an audience at a conference this, and they sympathized, I think, with a bit of kind of confusion.
So you were on a panel. What was this? This is it's the BPI, the British Phonographic Industries In Tune with Tomorrow events, which it's about the recorded music industry and how it can support talents for a sustainable future. Have I got that right?
Yeah. And, you know, not to kind of, blow smoke up anyone's bottom, but if you think of the stereotype of what a labels industry body event would be like, this wasn't it. Like it was a really diverse lineup, and they were talking about like really interesting. There was no kind of filler panels, no one quacking on about, you know, pitching their company.
Yeah.
And it was really good.
Any particular things that we should know about? Anyone who's a particularly good orator or speaker or someone who had ideas on how to change the way the music industry is shaped?
Yeah. Do you know, Faye Milton, who she was a drummer in Savages, the band, but she's now a co-founder of Music Declares Emergency. So they're the kind of, they're talking about how the music can fight the climate emergency. And so they're kind of helping people work out what to do. She was really good. Like she did a speech saying, and it was kind of a speech saying, look, this is a terrifying challenge about climate change, but super optimistic as well. She was like, look, this is what we can do. And music industry is brilliant because we have this cultural power and we can talk about this and do stuff. So that was like, some talks about climate can make you just feel daunted and overwhelmed, and this made you feel like, no, we can do stuff. And then there was this artist called Louis, so it's Louis VI, like you want to say Louis the Sixth because it's written like the king, but he's a British rapper and producer, but he's also got a degree in zoology, which is marvelous enough. And he did an album about the natural world, and he did a speech about nature and music and how sort of, you know, we need to be connecting music with the natural world. And again, with a kind of conservation climate thing. And it was just brilliant. Like it was a speech, but at times he started to kind of rap. He was getting into his flow and it was just like everyone was rapt. So it was like one of those things where an artist was talking about something important and just everyone in the room was really rapt. So yeah, those two were the ones that were really good.
We'll come back to the subject of nature before the end of the pod, strangely. But lots of news to cover once again. We'll start with this, which is a big story, but it will need a bit of time to explain some of the background to it, because this involves a company which not everyone will be aware of, but one which has grown significantly in this era where owning or leasing the rights to songs has become such a massive business, obviously not just for artists, but for the money men who like to dabble in the music industry. But it's all about, well, it's about two companies, but they're both called Hipgnosis. So for starters, can you tell us who they are and a bit about their history and what they do?
Yeah, it is one of those complicated things, because neither of them is the Hipgnosis that were the famous album cover designers. That's a completely different Hipgnosis again. So
yeah, confusingly, yeah.
So, I mean, if anyone's seen in recent years that this kind of talk about people buying up music catalogs and artists selling their song catalogs for hundreds of millions of dollars, Hipgnosis Songs Fund was one of the companies doing that. So they bought I mean, they bought a whole bunch of catalogs. They bought, I think, Neil Young, Shakira, Blondie, Barry Manilow, Chic. It's like if you listen to Greatest Hits Radio, it's like, you know, it's all those real kind of veteran heritage songwriters. So they bought a lot of catalogs. And then over the last year, they've had kind of a lot of stories in the papers about how is this working like they said it would? Are they making enough money? Are they in financial trouble? Like kind of the tide of coverage has turned from they're the hot new thing buying music rights to kind of are they in trouble? And that's been the last year.
Right.
And there's another company called Hypnosis Song Management. So Hypnosis Songs Fund, that's the fund that buys rights. Hypnosis Song Management, they are the investment advisors to that company. Founded by a chap called Merck Mercuriadis, a real music industry veteran, manager, entrepreneur. And Hypnosis Song Management was kind of the advisor, sort of saying, you know, which catalogs to buy, how much to pay for them, how to manage them. So it was like they were partners, both called the same thing, but they are separate entities. And what's happened now is they've fallen out at the same time as there's a kind of a bidding war starting for Hypnosis Songs Fund, the first company.
Right. So this is the story. And by the way, penniless musicians, turn away now if you don't want to be left weeping at the size of some of these monetary figures. So it's a takeover bid. But even this takeover bid, it's a lot more complicated than some takeover bids, as I can make out.
It certainly is. So like last week, a company called Concord, and they're one of the other big players in buying music catalogs, they're publishing. They came in and said, we'd like to buy Hypnosis Songs Fund, and we value it about $1.4 billion, which is a lot more. It was a public company. It's a lot more than it was trading for on the stock market. So they said, we think it's worth this. We'd like to buy it. And the next day, a company called Blackstone, who are one of the biggest investment companies in the world, they came in and said, we'd like to buy it, and we will pay $1.5 billion for this. So they kind of trumped them. But this is where it gets complicated because Blackstone is a financial backer of Hypnosis Song Management, the second company, that the advisor.
Right.
And in this agreement that the two Hypnosis have, there's this clause that's been well known for a while saying if Hypnosis Songs Fund ever terminates that deal, so if they say we don't want you to be advising us anymore, then Hypnosis Song Management has the right to buy all their song catalogs. And that's like one of the clauses. So, for example, if Hypnosis Songs Fund wanted to sell to someone else, that probably suggests they would need to terminate that agreement. We don't want you advising us because we're selling it to someone else and they can manage it. But Hypnosis Song Management is saying, and it put this really punchy statement out yesterday, like punchy by the standards of financial announcements, that if you terminate our agreement, we will exercise our right to buy the songs. And you know, you're going to sell them to us and we'll throw lawyers at you if you don't. And the added fun, I say fun, not fun if you're in the middle of it, but it's that recently Hypnosis Songs Fund commissioned this report into its business, which basically had a real punch after punch at Hypnosis Song Management, saying they hadn't been doing its job well. It had overvalued catalogs. It had not managed them well. It wasn't tracking things well enough. Like this report was basically a long, this is all the things I've done wrong, which as a layman, kind of a layman, my take on that was like, if you were thinking we'd like to terminate our partnership without having to sell them all the songs, proving that they've done their job badly would be one way you might go about that. And now Hypnosis Song Management is saying, no, that was unfair and wrong. We disagree with that report. And if you do try and do this without, you know, without following our contract, there'll be trouble. So that's where we've got to as we record. But I mean, so far, honestly, every day I've been having a press release from one side or the other saying, here's our latest statement. So by the time this comes out, even though it's tomorrow when we're recording, who knows? But it's looking like this company, Blackstone, may end up as the owner. They seem in pole position because they've bid more and they have this contract that they're kind of making menacing noises about. But it's a really messy end to this whole saga. And there's a lot of people in the music industry looking on, like half worried, because if Hypnosis came to a messy end, it might say, well, maybe music catalogs aren't worth as much as everyone thought they were. And that's bad for anyone who's trying to make money from them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's a lot of deck chairs and popcorn coming out of people who are saying, I told you so, it wouldn't end well. I did. There are people who maybe fallen out with Merck Mercuriadis in the past or have didn't think his model was right. There's kind of a fair amount of rubbernecking going on as this plays out. But it's still playing.
But the fact that there was an initial offer and then a counter offer, isn't that some sort of endorsement that someone must think that there's money in this business still, and that ownership of catalogs can still be profitable?
Well, yeah, and there was a really strange moment when Hypnosis' share price fell because of all the debate about whether it was doing well enough, so that the company was worth at one point about half of what the valuation of its music rights was. So people thought its music rights were worth about $1.4 billion, $1.3 billion, but the company was worth about 700 and something million. So it is strange. And there is this thing of like, okay, well, was it the company that was the issue, but those rights? I mean, it is, and the artists, that they're such good songwriters. Like those songs are evergreen songs that are being streamed every year. They're being used for TV ads, films. So yeah, I think you're right. Like this is kind of a battle at saying, that's a terrible way of describing music. These assets they have. But that's the weird thing for me, is this whole story of Hypnosis has been about music as an asset class. Like, is music something you can invest in and buy, and it grows in value? But
this is the interesting thing to me, because it is one of those stories that, I mean, it doesn't seem to affect the casual music fan. It will make no difference to us, but it is a good example of how business-minded people behind the scenes are attempting to make money out of music. I think, unless there are any implications, maybe not for fans, but for musicians down the line, if it turns out the catalogues have been overvalued.
Well, it is a reminder as well, like if you're a musician and you sell your catalogue to the company, and normally when you did that, you would say, I trust this company to manage my song catalogue well, and I'm trusting them with my work. But when songs are assets to be sold and bought, they might get sold. Like, you don't know who they'll end up with. That company might then sell them to someone else who you haven't thought they're the best person to look after. So it is that kind of reminder of, as a musician, if you have the opportunity to sell your works and take that kind of that initial payment, but you have no control then over who they end up with. And it's a little kind of cautionary tale about, if you're Neil Young, if you're Shakira, Blondie, you're kind of watching on, but you have no say in what happens next. You just have to wait to see who ends up owning this stuff.
Yeah. Next this week, as our own government dallies with ideas of what to do about streaming services and grassroots venues, over the other side of the Atlantic, the US Department of Justice is reportedly considering suing the major live music firm Live Nation. What's their problem with Live Nation?
Yeah, well, so like you said, this is just reports for now, but it's the Wall Street Journal, who I don't think would run a story saying this is going to happen if they weren't pretty sure that it was. The suggestion is that the Department of Justice is going to file an antitrust lawsuit against Live Nation. And the suggestion, again, all just kind of speculation, is that it's been too dominant in the US live market, and that it's used its power to kind of undermine competition from other ticketing firms who might want to kind of break into that market. And interesting, like, this has been bubbling for so long. Like, ever since Live Nation bought Ticketmaster, the biggest ticket firm, people have been saying that shouldn't have been allowed to happen. That's too big, too powerful a company. And people have said down the years, people should have stopped it. The regulator should have stopped it then, and they should crack down on it now. And over the last year, I think, there have been some stories, and there was Taylor Swift, and tickets were really hard to come by, and everything fell over. Bruce Springsteen, there was a big hoo-ha about how much tickets were costing for his gigs. And that has got US politicians riled up to kind of, we should do something about the ticketing market. It's not working well enough. And the interesting thing, I think, is that earlier in March, Live Nation has a guy who's like their policy chief. He's a guy who kind of defends them from all this stuff. And he wrote his big blog post explaining why they weren't a monopoly and they weren't harmful, which is kind of the thing you do if you were expecting this kind of case to be filed, maybe. Like, they've been getting their defense out in public early. So I think it's weird. I think you know more about ticketing and live than I do, but it's quite a nest of vipers, because you've got the ticketing, the big ticketing companies. You've got the secondary ticketing companies who are kind of constantly being criticized by elements of the music industry, but in turn they're criticizing Live Nation, and they're telling politicians, crack down on Live Nation, don't crack down on us. So you've got a lot of companies sticking their oar in, saying those people over there should be regulated. And Live Nation does that. It says, you know, the secondary ticketing firms, they should be regulated, not us. And so it seems like there's a lot going on. There's all kinds of bills going through the House of Congress. Some of them will crack down on secondary ticketing. Some of them will crack down on Live Nation, Ticketmaster. So it's all happening over there. But it sounds, Department of Justice antitrust lawsuit is kind of the biggest regulatory challenge you can face as like a tech or a media company. So it's going to be a really big challenge for Live Nation if and when it's announced.
Mm. Just while we're talking about live music, back over here, we should probably note that this week in London, the Brixton Academy has reopened following the awful events in December 2022 when two people died in a crowd stampede at a gig. You'll probably remember this story, which happened at the Academy, which was blamed, I think, on lax security and people having duplicate fake tickets, amongst other things. But the local council, Lambeth Council, have now agreed to the venue's reopening on the stipulation that it had to meet 77 extensive and robust new safety conditions. And I mention this, I mean, because I mean, no one's ever going to forget that dreadful night. But the Academy is a very important part of the British touring circuit. And it will also have quite an impact on the local economy as well, which has missed it, because it's just about the amount of people that go to gigs and how much money they spend on their way in or around the venue or in the venue. Because here's a stat which I'm not sure if you've come across this. This is from the National Arena Association, I think, who put out a report a while ago which said for every 10,000 people who attend a major gig, they contribute £1 million to the local economy, which I think probably does work at arena level. I mean, they probably do spend near £100 each at an arena gig. I mean, but I mean, at academy level, I'm guessing it would be a bit less. But even if you tone that figure down, even if you halved it, that would be something like £50, and the Academy holds about 5,000, 6,000, so it's 5,000 people. That would still mean that every gig at the Academy would be worth around £250,000 to the South London economy, which is still, that's a significant figure, isn't it? And to think that that's been missing from the economy. And that is also, whether it's an arena venue or a grassroots venue, that's why live music can be really important to communities, whether it's, you know, the travel that people are spending on or the end of night kebab. There's a lot of money in live music attached to live music. And also, the other thing I noticed about the relaunch, they did a test gig, like a trial gig, which I know a couple of people who went to it. But the first gig featured two tribute bands. And here's the stat you might not know. On average, this is certainly true at grassroots level, I was told this. On average, venues take 160% more over the bar for a tribute band night compared to a new band night. 160% more in beer sales for a tribute band night. And that hence why your local venue is often propped up by the Clone Roses or Noasis. Other tribute bands are available.
Is that so that you can kind of squint slightly fuzzily and think it's the real thing?
It's probably possibly something to do with the demographic of the audience, I imagine. And also, I mean, the popularity of tribute bands. I mean, quite often you see the tribute band nights are sold out because people quite like something reliable, something they know, rather than, you know, just having spending £10 on a random bunch of three new artists. However great those new artists may be, you're not guaranteed, I think in some people say, it's a great night out compared to going and seeing a band play the entire back catalogue of the Smiths.
Can I do my favourite tribute band / alcohol anecdote? But it will involve swearing. Are we allowed to swear? Because the swearing is quite a key part of it.
I mean, probably no one's listening. Go on.
So I saw Fake That once, long time ago. Right. And the crowd, it was a very, very, it was like a student media awards thing, I think. And the crowd were very much, they'd been taking part of the bar. And so it was poor Fake That tribute came back. And the Mark Owen was getting particular heckles from the audience because he was right. He was about 20 years old, too old to be Mark Owen. And there's this moment when he snapped all the heckles and they were singing Babe and he went, Babe, no, you fuck off. And then back into the song. It's like, honestly, I think he won the crowd round with that moment. you know, because it was one of the best mid-line dispatches of heckling I've ever seen, and it was fake that.
We've got a couple more live music stories to come in a minute, but first, well, there may be no end so far to the ongoing Universal versus TikTok dispute, but TikTok is forging on with its own musical strategy, including its first live music pop-up, which is taking place this week.
Yeah, in London, actually. So yeah, on 24th and 25th, which I think is Wednesday and Thursday, isn't it? So, today
and tomorrow. Yeah.
And it's also going to be streamlined. Interestingly, it's near King's Cross Station. And you know who? What else is near King's Cross Station? The headquarters of Universal Music Group. So, you know, I'm not saying that had anything to do with the decision, but I'm also not saying that that's not the reason.
It's artists
who've built their audience on TikTok. So, Fia Hamilton, Chrissy Grimsdale, who does Disney songs, who was new to me, and Charlie Tyler and Russell James Williams, who is a good link here coming in a minute. So it's going to have artists who are kind of, you call them TikTok native, and they're all going to be performing and, you know, drawing a crowd.
Yeah, we are going to be talking to Charlie and Russ, who found success through TikTok, on the next edition of this podcast. I guess what we're trying to find out firsthand how musicians are making money and building careers using TikTok. So that will be with you in a couple of days' time. This next story, well, this is something of a warning for fans of major artists, as we learn that Taylor Swift followers have lost an estimated £1 million in ticket scams ahead of the UK leg of her Eras tour. Is this the murky world of ticket touting, or is this something else more sinister?
No, it's more sinister. And this is one of those stories, you see a big number and think, I wonder who's made this number up. But it comes from Lloyds Bank, who, in terms of putting numbers out, so Lloyds Bank issued an urgent warning about Taylor Swift ticket scams. And this is about people posting adverts and posts on Facebook saying Taylor Swift tickets, which, because the gigs are sold out this summer, tickets are rarer than hen's teeth. They're posting these on social media and saying you can buy tickets here. Mm-hmm. And apparently, according to Lloyds, so since tickets went on sale last year, more than 600 customers have told it we've been scammed. Like we thought we were buying tickets and we weren't. Some people lost more than £1,000. I think the average was like £332 each. And so Lloyds has said, right, well, if this is the same for the other big banks, then there could be at least 3,000 victims of these frauds, and that could be over £1 million lost to the people doing these scams. So it's genuinely like these are the hottest tickets in London this summer, I think. And there, people have gone, right, well, there's some money to be made here by just defrauding people. But it's not just, it's also, I think they said it happened last year for Coldplay and Harry Styles and Beyonce. So it's kind of that level artists where if you don't get tickets the minute they go on sale, no chance. And then you're maybe you're ripe for someone on social media going, yeah, we've still got tickets. Here you go. Just click through and put your credit card in and Bob's your uncle.
So be aware. Talking of Taylor Swift, did you see Taylor Swift broke another streaming record the other day? Taylor Swift's new album was streamed more than 300 million times on the day of its release. 300 million times, which would make, how much money does that generate? I need a calculator. Have you got one of those? I think you've got access to one of those bits of software where you can calculate royalty rates. Have you?
Yeah, there's a law company in the States that have got a streaming calculator. And so 300 million streams on Spotify is about $1.4 million. So £1.1 million. So not weirdly similar to the amount that's been scammed out of fans, which is an unfortunate point.
Yeah, she could reimburse everyone who's been scammed. There you go. But you know, just from one for one day's work.
It's so funny because the funny thing is that the album, on the day of release, it became the first album to ever do 200 million streams in a day on Spotify.
Yeah.
So 200 million. And then like a few hours later, oh no, it's 300 million now as well. So it's really, but it's 31 tracks. Like we should talk about this sometime, about albums getting longer. But I think it was like 16 tracks when it came out at midnight. And then at 2 a.m. Taylor Swift goes, by the way, there's another 15 tracks that I'm also dropping. And this album became a 31 track, you know, I don't know what you call it, odyssey. Yeah. So It's like the scale is fans streaming that very long album with lots of tracks, but lots of people doing it as well.
Yeah. You might remember a few weeks back we mentioned the 1975 and their Carbon Removed gigs, which gave us a chance to mention the O2's Wormery. Well, now the O2 Arena has revealed just how its Carbon Removed gigs actually went.
Yeah, so I mean, just to recap, I suppose. Well, we should recap the Wormery because that's the best thing.
They've got a Wormery at the O2 to help with the food waste. But this was it's quite a well reported initiative. And it seemed like it seemed like a great idea. Did it work to the level that they were hoping?
Seemingly so. So basically, they calculated how much carbon emissions the event would generate. And that's everything from inside the venue to fans traveling to the venue. And then the O2, AAG is the owner of the O2. They paid for some of this. And they added, I think it was 90p to the price of a ticket. And that covered the emissions generated by fans traveling. So fans played their part. And yeah, apparently more than five. And then they use that money to kind of do projects that remove carbon from the atmosphere. So an equal amount of carbon. And yet, apparently, more than 545 tons of residual carbon were removed from the atmosphere across the four nights. And that AEG said that's the yearly electricity usage of 395 average homes, which is, and that's just four nights. So you sort of think, okay, if this was being done at every concert in every arena, it's And I think they're very keen to present this as a case study for other people to learn from. So we could be seeing more concerts using this kind of model to try and balance their emissions out. So yeah, it seems like it went well, and the fact that they're sharing that information is going to be good, I think, as well.
Mm-hmm. And finally, see, I told you we'd come back to nature. Nature has been recognised as a musical artist in its own right. How much money is Nature going to make out of pop music, or is Nature's contribution purely altruistic? I don't understand. Nature has been recognised as a musical artist.
Yeah, so this is a project led by the UN, actually, called Sounds Right. And it's about generating money for conservation projects. So it was announced for around Earth Day, which was earlier this week. Mm-hmm. And so a group of artists have added nature sounds, so everything rainfall and rivers and buzzing bees and, you know, nature and wildlife sounds to their tracks. And then they've credited nature as a collaborator, as if nature was an artist with them, which means that there's a portion of those royalties is going to, you know, quote marks, nature. And I believe it's Earth Percent, the charity, is going to be, has rounded up a group of experts, like biologists and environmental experts and climate experts, mm-hmm. who are going to say, right, this money's come in, we're going to decide what projects to put it towards. And it's, some big names like Ellie Goulding, Brian Eno and David Bowie, Aurora, and then this Louis VI, who I saw talk yesterday, which is why I mentioned him. So it's a bunch of like a big name artists. And the funny thing, in his talk, Louis said nature is now in the top 10% of streaming artists, apparently, already.
Really?
And I checked on Spotify. Nature has more than 1.8 million monthly listeners. But he made a really good point in his speech, because one of the things we've heard about recently is like this idea of like making music is uniquely human. And when people say that, it's because they're saying it's not AI music. And it's a big part of that debate about AI is only humans make music. And he was like, try saying music is uniquely human to a nightingale or a humpback whale. So his point was like music, there is actually music in nature and it inspires humans to make music. Maybe, he was saying, I think like maybe the first time we made music was because we heard birds singing, you know, it's kind of a way of connecting things back, but also raising money. And there's a playlist on Spotify of nature music. And it just seems like a really inventive way of doing this, like it makes people think about nature and conservation, but it's also artists doing interesting creative stuff, so you know, you get to listen to it. So it's fun, and it's do you know, it follows there was a thing last year that was some of the same people involved, Earth Percent, where people were crediting Earth as a songwriter on their songs.
Oh, really?
So now you've got, and they credit Earth. And again, that portion of the royalties would then go to Earth Percent. You've now got Earth is a songwriter and nature is an artist. So if they collaborate, it's good. I like it. It's like, I think that there's a lot of work going on to figure out music and climate change and what can music do? Yeah. And this is one of the things that's going to, it's got a bunch of headlines, but it's also making a difference because that money is going to go to good projects.
Excellent. That's where we'll leave it for this episode. As mentioned, the stars of TikTok talk to us in the next one. For now, though, thank you very much for listening. And if you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe to us in your podcast app. And if you can, give us a rating because it helps with spreading the word and improving what we do. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, we are preparing another of our listeners' questions specials. So anything that's you might be struggling with because it's, I mean, we're all about trying to inform and demystify this mad business. So anything you're not quite sure about when it comes to music finances, drop us a line, email us at this address, Stuart.
Yeah, it's the price of music podcast at gmail.com. And at this event I went to for the BPI, a man came up to me, a very nice man came up to me and said, I love the show and I've got a question for you. And it was a really good question. So hopefully if you're listening, he'll send it in because I think you it's a question you'd enjoy, but I'll tell you off air.
Okay. You tease. Thanks very much, everybody. Take care. Cheers.